Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How different will the world be a century from now? As president of the strategic global intelligence firm Stratfor, George Friedman often uses available information to predict geopolitical events a year or even a decade away. But as a personal challenge for his latest project, Friedman set his sights on a much more distant time horizon, looking ahead to an era of space-based energy harvesting, global population decline, and extraordinary technological advances. So what tells him all of this is possible? George Friedman explains in his best-selling new book, The Next 100 Years, A Forecast for the 21st Century. We are happy to have him on the show to talk about it. George, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with this. You're not claiming to have a crystal ball here. These predictions are based on your best guesses for how the future could play out. Can you talk about what elements of current events and of history that you've used to make those guesses?
Well, I mean, history has certain constants. Every century has wars. Every century has new powers rising, old powers falling. So if you're standing at the beginning of the 1900, and you're the great powers of the world, the superpowers are Britain and France, and Germany is emerging, you really have a problem imagining that at the end of the century, these will be fairly minor players on the international stage. What you do is you examine the underlying strengths and weaknesses of these countries, some of the issues that divide them. For example, that Germany is challenging France and Britain. Then you try to imagine what a war between these countries would look like. And if you consider the combination of great power rivalries and dynamite, you start to get a vision of the kind of casualties, stresses, and so on that you're going to have. And then you look over the horizon and you look at the United States, this third world country rising out of nowhere. So in other words, what you do is you become very stupid. I say that by the sense is there are a lot of enormously sophisticated people who will explain to you why all of this is far too complex to understand. But if you take a look at the simple and obvious facts, so there are two simple obvious facts of the 21st century. The first is that ever since 1870, the United States has been an enormously powerful country, an increasingly powerful country. So in 1870, we were essentially a third world country, impoverished, underpopulated, and everything. When we take a look at the single most important thing that happened in the world in the past 150 years, it's clearly the emergence of the United States as global power. You've seen the United States brush off things from Vietnam to the Great Depression. And so you say, okay, what is going to limit American growth? And I'll make the argument that very little. You also look at other countries and take a look at what will limit their growth and allow them to rise. And then you look at the other factor, which is that the population explosion is coming to an end. Birth rates everywhere in the world are collapsing. In the advanced industrial countries, where it's most advanced, the population of Germany in 30 years will be 25% of what it is today. Capitalism for 500 years has been about one thing: more people, more consumers, more producers, more soldiers, more everything. For the first time in 500 years, there's going to be a shortage of a single thing: labor. So you take the rise of the United States, the least populated country in the world in some senses, and the rise of this crisis of labor, and you see the next step of American power. It's not very sophisticated, but it's very obvious.
Yeah, and in fact, you think that the debates we're having now, fierce debates over not just immigration, but illegal immigration in particular, will be completely moot as the United States moves back into giving incentives to people to immigrate to this country in the same way that we did in the Lincoln administration.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's an arithmetic fact. Okay, the population, the Anglo population, is reproducing at an extraordinarily low rate for obvious reasons. Having children is very expensive. It is also an aging population. It's a population that will retire at 65. Social Security was created a retirement age of 65 when life expectancy was 62. Life expectancy is now 80. So clearly the Social Security system is not designed to support an aging population. What do we do? Well, one, we can let people die in the streets. Or two, we can bring in labor. Now, at the same time that the United States is bringing in labor, every other advanced industrial country in the world is going to be looking for labor as well. So while right now we're at the edge of that time when there was always a labor surplus, and the real issue is how to keep them out, in 30 years, it's an arithmetic certainty that the problem is going to be how to get them in. And in a world where labor is scarce, the price of importation will rise.
And ultimately, how does that affect our relationship with Mexico?
Well, in the long run, we have a very troubled relationship with Mexico. The United States in the 19th century stole northern Mexico fair and square by the rules of the game. The Mexicans have never been in a position to challenge that. Mexico today is the world's 13th largest economy. Very few people understand that. It is an enormous economy. It is entering the first tier of global economies. It is also in a position where it is exporting labor into the United States, particularly concentrated in the former Mexican cession, changing the demographics in this borderland between the two countries. Between the movement of population, that's a pull movement, we're drawing them in, and the fact that, quite contrary to what everybody seems to think, Mexico is turning into an economic superpower. When we look beyond the current chaos that's going on there 50, 60, 70 years down the road, we see the North American continent shared by two major powers, an enormously powerful United States, and a rising and quite assertive Mexico with a bone pick.
How will the tension between the U.S. and Mexico be mitigated or perhaps exacerbated by the fact that so many Americans in 70 or 80 years will have Mexican blood?
Well, I mean, that will either be the solution or the problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that they have Mexican blood will raise the question of their ultimate identity. There's a difference between Mexican immigration in the United States and other immigrants, which is that other immigrants leave their country very far behind, India, China, Eastern Europe, whatever, and form their communities here in the United States. The movement of Mexican population is essentially a movement into a borderland, not into a foreign country, but into a borderland that has, on several instances, changed hands between the two countries. So it's an extension of the population beyond its political borders, but culturally and economically, they still link back. One of the great strengths of the United States has been its ability to assimilate immigrants so they develop an American identity. That's always a challenge with a country sending immigrants into contiguous territory, not just for the United States, but all through Europe you see the same problem and phenomenon. So this is going to be a very large challenge for the United States and for Mexico, which is that they are going to have a dispute over a borderland that appeared to be settled in the 1840s, but in fact remains an open question.
Where does all this leave Canada?
Canada is left to the north of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
by that I mean Canada is a very small country.
Yeah,
it is a very thin country. Look at a map, it appears huge. It is a country that has population essentially concentrated 200 to 300 miles north of its border with the United States. And most of its trade is not east-west within Canada, it's north-south with the United States. So where Mexico is a country of over 100 million people, very integrated into one culture, Canada is a very different, very diverse country that essentially focuses in on the United States and can't be regarded as a real challenge.
You do imagine that we could learn something from the state of Quebec, where language has been an issue for a long time.
Well, I mean, one of the things we can learn from the state of Quebec is that where assimilation doesn't take place, where someone regards himself as not part of the country but conquered in some distant past, language becomes a political tool and it becomes a very divisive force. I mean, it's one thing for an immigrant from Poland to celebrate the history of Poland here in the United States, but it's really not going to have any political impact. It's quite different in Quebec, where you have a large population that regards the rest of Canada as a conquering power.
So as we continue to grow our technological capabilities and economies, you do see English as the dominant language in that factor. Will English someday truly be a global language, and then we'll all speak some other local language in addition to that to preserve sort of cultural heritage?
Well, the way I would put it is computers are a global language.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is that most computer languages, how you would program, are in English. So if you want to become a programmer writing significant programs in China or the United States or Argentina or where have you, you need to learn English. So in the same way that French was the lingua franca in the 18th century, or Latin during the Roman period, the language that you must speak if you want to engage in today's commerce is English, not because the United States simply is that economically powerful. It is, but that's not the only reason. It's because our technology is based on language, and that language is English.
Can you write about the geographic factors that put the United States in a better position than many of its potential rivals?
Well, I mean, begin with the fact that the United States occupies a continent, a very powerful thing to do, with no immediate threats from either the Indians or the Mexicans, and that as part of controlling this continent, the United States really is able to exploit resources that others can't. Let me give you two really interesting figure. Japan has 365 people per square kilometer. Germany has about 260. The United States has 34, and that's not counting Alaska. And even if you only count arable land, the United States is vastly underpopulated. But there's another dimension to this. Up until recently, the key to power in the world was the North Atlantic. Whoever in Europe controlled the North Atlantic had access to the world, to India, what have you, and therefore the access to wealth. In 1980, an extraordinary thing happened that we never saw before. For the first time in history, trans-Pacific trade equaled transatlantic trade. This changed the entire dynamics of global trade. Now, any country that is native to both the Atlantic and the Pacific has a tremendous advantage, not just in terms of shipping, but in terms of being able to project power. So the Asian powers really are in no position to project power into the Atlantic. The European powers are in no position to project power into the Pacific. The United States and the U.S. Navy is able to project power cheaply and efficiently into both. And that gives us a tremendous political military advantage as well as an economic advantage over everyone else.
And how do you see Japan's role in the Pacific changing over the next 100 years?
Well, Japan is the world's second largest economy. You know, we spend a lot of time talking about China, but Japan towers over China as an economic power. There was a time in the 1980s when we spoke of Japan as the next superpower, overwhelming the United States. Well, that obviously didn't happen. But Japan remains certainly the second largest economy in the world. It also has an excellent navy, the largest in Asia. It has a good air force. It has a substantial army, and this is while it's officially a pacifist country. You know, we spend a lot of time talking about the Chinese challenge, but it's actually Japan that both historically and currently is the substantial power. Now, there's this issue. Who dominates the Pacific, the United States or the Japanese? That was settled in 1945. It is going to be discussed again.
George Friedman is with us. He's president of Stratfor. His new book is called The Next 100 Years, A Forecast for the 21st Century. You're welcome to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is president of Stratfor, George Friedman. His new book is called The Next 100 Years, A Forecast for the 21st Century. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So we'll get back to our discussion of the Pacific countries. You think that there could be a breakup of China. How might that play itself out?
Well, we have to remember that China is a third world country. We Americans go to a few cities, and there's been remarkable growth in those areas. But on average, the average Chinese has his life has a standard of living about on the order of Nigeria. I mean, this is an extraordinarily poor country with a very thin veneer of industrialization. China is also an extension of the American economy. In the sense that if the United States winds up in a recession, this is catastrophic for China because it has no domestic market for most of its products. It has to ship them overseas. Right now, the Europeans aren't buying, so it's the Americans. In China, unemployment doesn't mean what it means in the United States, which is very painful and difficult, but in China, it means, for many people, near starvation. Since many of these workers are earning $60 or $70 a month, they lose their jobs. They have nothing. And the government is terribly afraid of that. So they have a choice. They can keep inefficient businesses in operation by subsidizing them, thus using up their substantial reserves, or they can close the businesses, accept unemployment, and accept social unrest. As we calculated, over the long run, not just because of this financial slowdown, but a range of issues, the Chinese surge is coming to an end, and the consequence is going to be internal social instability. And we really have to remember that prior to 1970, China, for well over a century, lived in a state of ongoing chaos. The last few years are extraordinarily different from what went in the past, but it shouldn't be assumed that it's sustainable. And the Chinese government is quite worried about it as well. And so our forecast is that China will, over the next course of a century, revert to the kind of condition it was in most of the 19th and 20th century of regional conflict, warlordism, and all sorts of instability.
Would any of those smaller regions, if they were to actually break out into different countries, would they actually fare better, these rural areas, than they do now under the Chinese government?
Well, the people that will want to stay away from the Chinese government are the wealthy areas. One of the government's strategy is to tax these areas and transfer their wealth to the much poorer areas that are more populous and more dangerous. The very same thing happened in the late 19th century. And these areas found it in their interest to side with the imperial powers like Britain or Germany, France, the United States, and use their support to keep these people at a distance. So what you really have to look for is not so much China breaking into separate countries. China is one country. But what you really have to look for is China operating in a kind of regionalized atmosphere with flowing, changing loyalties and so on.
Will it remain at least nominally communist for the foreseeable future?
Well, nominally, I guess if by that you mean that we're going to see a country that is dominated by the Communist Party. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that Communist Party is particularly an ideological element.
How will Turkey grow in geopolitical importance? This is one of the most fascinating things, I think, that you posit in the book.
Well, begin with the fact that Turkey today is the world's 17th largest economy. It has a larger economy than Saudi Arabia. It is, in the Islamic world, by far the greatest economic power. It is also a great, substantial regional military power. Its army and air force are U.S.-sponsored and really excellent. Now, consider the fact that the United States is withdrawing from the region. It's really had quite enough of that war. And Turkey can't withdraw. And what you're seeing already throughout the entire region is the spreading of Turkish influence. Whether you go to the Balkans, to the Caucasus, to Central Asia, to Iraq, to Syria, you see Turkish businessmen, Turkish military advisors, you see the Turks present, which makes a great deal of sense in an economy where everything is wrecked, if you will, where one country has so much economic power, everybody's attracted to them. Whenever there was a great Islamic power in the world, not always, but almost always, it was Turkish in some sense. And, of course, the Ottoman Empire, which governed for 500 years and collapsed in 1922, is the great symbol of that. What we're simply saying is that the Turkish economy has already recovered to a great extent from World War I. The Turkish military recovered a long time ago. It is the only viable power in the Islamic world, and it has a vested interest in bringing stability to the Islamic world, so its own regime isn't threatened. We already see it emerging as a major regional power, and there are very few limits on where it can go.
And you think that we may be in the last days of what we now consider this critical war on terror?
Well, yes. I mean, clearly the war in Iraq is effectively over. The debate we have now is whether we will pull our last troops out in 2011, as George Bush wanted, or 2010, as Barack Obama wants. That's a fairly trivial argument. In Afghanistan, the United States really is not going to conquer Afghanistan. That's quite not possible. Alexander the Great didn't do it. The British didn't do it. The Russians didn't do it. And whether we have 30 or 60,000 troops in the country, we're not going to do it. It's a vast country. Our supplies running into Afghanistan are in jeopardy. They run through Pakistan from the port of Karachi to the Khyber Pass, and those supply lines are under attack. We are talking to the Russians about providing us another line of supply into Afghanistan, and while they may be prepared to do that, their price is going to be extremely high, so we really have to ask the question, what's the value of Afghanistan? We are in Afghanistan not because we really care what government Afghanistan has, I hope. We're in Afghanistan because we want to deny sanctuary to Islamic terrorists. It is at this point important to recognize that al-Qaeda has not successfully attacked the United States since 2001. This is not because they didn't want to or they didn't try. They certainly did. It has to do with the success of previous administration's policies in creating situations in which Islamic states use their intelligence service to suppress al-Qaeda. And, you know, whatever else we say about them, we didn't have another attack. There are those who say there would never have been one, but I think they're very wrong. So in terms of what we set out to do, we've achieved our primary mission. Al-Qaeda is no longer a functional group. There may be other Islamic groups that arise, but the occupation of Afghanistan isn't practical. And so, therefore, we've reached a point of the end game where the debate is precisely what terms we withdraw under, not what terms we increase our forces.
George Friedman is my guest. He's president of Stratfor. His new book is called The Next 100 Years, A Forecast for the 21st Century. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. George, there's been a lot of talk over the past year or so with this tension over missile heads in Poland that we're starting yet another Cold War with Russia, similar to the one that we had with the USSR. Under what conditions, though, do you think the U.S. and Russia could return to full Cold War conditions?
Well, I don't think they're going to return to full Cold War conditions, but certainly there's a massive rivalry developing there. While the United States was off balance and committed all of its forces to Iraq and Afghanistan, the Russians saw a window of opportunity open, a period of time in which the Russians could reassert their power within what they called a near abroad, their region, and the United States could not respond. The United States had committed itself to NATO expansion to Ukraine and Georgia, had sponsored any number of uprisings in these countries, like the Orange Revolution in the Ukraine. And it was the Russian intention to reverse this trend because they saw these revolutions as essentially as CIA plots designed to install pro-Western regimes around the Russian periphery, which they didn't want. The problem from the Russian point of view was that the Americans had a great deal of credibility in the former Soviet Union among these regimes as protecting them. Therefore, what was important about the Georgia War was that the Russians demonstrated to other countries in the former Soviet Union and Poland that a guarantee from the United States isn't worth the paper it's written on. So they invaded. They destroyed the Georgian army, and the United States responded by writing a very strong note. This was noticed in every capital. And I suspect that we will have a pro-Russian government in Ukraine in the next 6 to 12 months. And the Russians are reasserting their sphere of influence. Now, the border of the sphere of influence is Poland. That just happens to be the case. But Poland is caught between Germany and Russia. It's two great nightmares from history. The Germans are very heavily dependent on the Russians because the Russians have become massive importers and exporters of natural gas. And almost 50% of the natural gas the Germans absorb comes from Russia. And the Germans are in absolutely no position to resist the Russians and have made it very clear they're not going to be cooperating with President Obama on any of the things that he's asked for because they need to work with the Russians. The Poles are terrified. They are caught between more assertive Russia and Germany working with Russia. They, therefore, have an interest in a third power protecting them. The United States has a vested interest in making sure that Western Europe and Russia don't in some way unite because the industrial strength of Western Europe coupled with the natural resources of Russia would be quite a combination to cope with. And so Poland suddenly emerges as a country at the pivot. The United States has said it wants to put a missile defense system, not accidentally, in Poland. Now, there's no reason that it has to be in Poland. In fact, it's not even that important. But the United States wants to demonstrate to the Russians that it will, with or without German support, with or without NATO support, be prepared to make commitments to Poland. The Russians don't care at all about the ballistic missile defense system. They understand fully that it has no impact on their power. But they want to make certain that the United States doesn't put it in there because it does not want to have a strong Poland united with the United States on its borders. So we have a non-issue hiding a fundamental issue. And the fundamental issue is, at what point does the Russian reassertion of power end? Will it end within the former Soviet Union? Will it extend somehow to Poland and other former Eastern European powers? What role will NATO play in all this? What role will the United States play in all this? And what appears to be the case is NATO plays very little role. Russia will assert itself to the limits of what's possible. And the United States and Poland are moving into a very close strategic relationship.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. If you'd like to speak to George Friedman, you can call us or you can send an email to think@kera.org. The book we're discussing today is called The Next 100 Years, A Forecast for the 21st Century. Let's go to Ramus in Dallas. Hey, Ramus.
Yes, great show, by the way. You know, the Russians have very every reason to be upset. I mean, you know, they took great steps towards democracy, which we don't really give them credit for, only kind of like a half a way because we have to. And we're trying to put missiles in their backyard. But when they tried to do it in Cuba, we were ready to start World War III for that. They want respect, and we are not willing to give them that respect. But let's not forget, Russia can blow up the world 10 times over still. And the problem is the media has been showing on TV to the average American how poor Russia is and how low the standard of living for the Russians is. And therefore, if you ask an American on the street what you think about Russia as a threat, their response would be, Russia. They're nothing. They're starving. And that's wrong. That's wrong. The American ignorance is once again showing again, and it will push them to another Cold War, who only ended on paper. It never really ended between the United States and Russia.
Ramus, thanks for your call. What do you think about that, George?
Well, I think it's true that Americans underestimate Russia, but not nearly as much as the Russians underestimate the United States. I mean, the caller made a point that we really don't understand Russia. I've been in Europe a great deal, and I can almost guarantee that Americans understand Europe far better than Europeans understand the United States. In this particular case, I mean, there's certainly a view of Russia that goes from it is a terrible threat to it's a joke. There's also a view in Russia of the United States as a failed state because of the financial crisis or as a great oppressor. And like all countries, we totally misunderstand each other. So I'm really not interested in questions, I understand why the caller raised them, of respect between nations. This is not a club, and respect is not an issue. It's a question of power. The Russians are a rising power for the moment. The United States is an overwhelming power. While the Americans are distracted, the Russians are trying to grab as much as they can. But if there were another Cold War, which I'm not sure there will be, this will end even more catastrophically than the last one for the Russians. So where I disagree with the caller is these are not two equal powers. One is enormously more powerful than the other. Russia has a temporary advantage within its sphere of influence that it's exploiting very skillfully. But the reason that I don't believe it'll become another Cold War is because the Russians really can't afford one. As to their ability to blow up the world many times over, I note the fact that many countries have nuclear weapons, none have used them. It is not a very effective instrument of the state.
So you don't imagine a major nuclear weapon detonation by a country in the next century?
I really find it very difficult to believe. I mean, I remember when we all agreed that Mao Zedong was completely insane and would certainly use weapons immediately if he got them. And then he got them and he didn't use them. So, I mean, that's a long, complex story, but I don't see nuclear weapons as very significant in the general scheme of things.
George Friedman is with us. He is president of Stratfor. His new book is called The Next 100 Years, A Forecast for the 21st Century. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is president of the strategic global intelligence firm Stratfor. George Friedman's new book is called The Next 100 Years, A Forecast for the 21st Century. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Let us go to the phone now and speak to Scott in Grapevine. Hey, Scott.
Hi. My question was, what does the guest see as the realistic possibility of fossil fuels such as oil and natural gas being phased out or abandoned over the next century, and then what effect that would have on countries like Saudi Arabia, UAE, and like even Venezuela?
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Well, certainly I think the what I'll call the hydrocarbon economy is coming to an end. I don't know whether that's because of climate change. I don't understand that process. But I do understand that the economics of hydrocarbons is becoming unsustainable. Clearly, solar energy is a superior choice. Nuclear energy is always pointed out. But the problem is that it takes so long to build a nuclear plant that by the time you're finished, the market has shifted, growing bigger or smaller. It's very hard to have a 10, 15, 20-year project that hits the market. What you need is something you can scale. Essentially, solar energy is the logical one. Wind power is solar energy. So is, of course, photovoltaic cells. The problem with wind power is you really have to have an awful lot of these windmills. And if you ever go out to West Texas, it'll take your breath away how the landscape has been changed and, my view, degraded. The problem with direct solar power is two things, night and clouds, and the fact that no matter how efficient you use them, you're going to have to make a huge amount of them to create the electricity you need, and that could cover up a good part of the Southwest, just for the United States. The impact on the environment is just enormous. I believe solar power will be used, but I don't think it will be used on the face of the Earth. It will be used in space. It will be space-based because you don't have clouds, you don't have night, and you don't have environmental impacts. You can send the energy back to Earth either through cables tethered through satellites or through microwave, very narrow beam microwave radiation to receivers and then into the electrical grid. And lest you think that this is completely insane, NASA already has a major program underway on space-based solar systems. So this is certainly something the government is considering. One of the geopolitical consequences of this, of course, is that if the United States did this, and we're the only power with a presence in space sufficient to even consider this, we become more powerful than Saudi Arabia. In fact, we become the major energy supplier to the Earth. That, of course, massively increases American power. It certainly reduces our dependence on hydrocarbon fuels. There are a lot of things that have to be done between them. I mean, the single most important thing is a storage system for electricity. I mean, the benefit of gasoline is that it's a superb storage system for energy. If I start my car 3 months from now, the energy is still stored. None of it has been lost. It's there. We really don't know how to store electricity efficiently. But assuming that we do learn how to store it that efficiently, and I think we will, the question is how do we generate it? And I think it's going to be in space. And I think it's going to be with very well-known technologies. In fact, most of the technologies we need for space-based solar energy production already exist. I also note that people like Jeff Bezos and Branson, who runs Virgin Airlines, both have little programs they're running on developing space-based systems. They say that this is, developing rockets for tourism, which may well be the case, but I have a suspicion they're more ambitious. Everybody's looking for inexpensive ways to put things into space, and the most important thing you want to put up there are solar collectors.
Well, clearly, space-based energy collection also ups the ante for a space war. Can you talk a little bit about that and about what you anticipate for the third world war that this planet has seen?
Well, at this point, if a major power wanted to fight the United States, they would have to take out our space-based assets right this minute. We run our communications through space, our navigational systems through space, and, of course, our intelligence and reconnaissance platforms through space. It is extraordinary just how dependent a squad on patrol in Afghanistan is on space for its operations. That's only going to increase. Certainly, any major power that wants to go to war with us is going to try to knock out our space-based assets. We have to protect those space-based assets. They will put up other space-based assets. So I will make the argument that the wars of the 21st century, the major wars, will, to a very great extent, take place in space. If you can control the high ground, if you can see deep into the enemy territory, if you can deliver munitions with precision, the entire shape of war changes. So as I see the great powers struggling in the 21st century, and of course I see wars in the 21st century, because every century has wars, I think we will be surprised in the same way that no one in the 19th century could imagine that wars in the 20th century would be so heavily focused on air power. I think wars in the 21st century will be heavily focused on space power.
We have an email here from Joel who asks, what do you think about the possibility of a single world currency after the worldwide economic collapse?
Well, we haven't had a worldwide economic collapse. We've had a worldwide economic problem. We're way away from collapse, and we really have to be careful about the terms we use.
Yeah, you feel like, and I've read a lot of what you've written about this, you think we don't really have very much perspective on what we're going through right now.
Well, you know, I'm an old guy. I remember the 70s. I remember when you couldn't buy or sell a house because interest rates were 17 or 18%. Unemployment was well over 10%. Inflation was well over 10%. You couldn't buy gasoline for any price whatsoever because there were just gasoline shortages. We'd lost the war in Vietnam. We were being humiliated in Iran. And everybody was convinced that it couldn't be worse than this. I remember a similar crisis in 1982 with very similar numbers. I remember in the 1970s, the municipal bond market had become totally irresponsible, and the city of New York had to be bailed out, along with Chrysler the first time. I remember when the third world bond market collapsed, creating a worldwide crisis in currencies and bonds, and we created something called the Brady Bond, essentially taking over the debt of third world countries that couldn't pay them and guaranteeing it. I remember when the savings and loan institutions, an entire sector of the financial system, collapsed, and the federal government came in with $650 billion, which was real money then, you know, not like now, $650 billion to take over the banks and bail out much of the investments they had made in commercial real estate. So from where I sit, the American economy cycles in a number of ways. It grows. It grows to excess in irrationality. It becomes irrational. The government intervenes to save it. Everyone declares that the world is over. There's no hope. We're finished. And then 15 years later, when you remind them of the last time they said that, they can't quite remember it. When I look at this crisis, it's a very painful crisis. My son is an architect, and he lost his job. That's a problem. And he may move in with us, and that's a tragedy. So these are very serious things. But from saying that we're having a serious cyclical problem to saying that our situation is unprecedented and catastrophic really is a stretch. I mean, no way in any way does this look like the Great Depression, when the economy contracted by 50% and over a quarter of the population was unemployed. It doesn't even look as bad as 82. In fact, everybody keeps saying this is the worst unemployment figure we've had since 1982. To which the answer is, oh, so 1982 is worse than this. But I will bet you among our listeners of the age who can remember it, a whole lot of them don't remember how bad it was. We just don't have perspective.
So are you buying up stock bargains right now?
I'm getting real interested. Baron Rothschild said, buy when there's blood in the streets. Mostly, I buy when Newsweek has a headline that says, we're all socialists now. You know, when the media starts saying that we have a worldwide collapse, let's say, that's a great time to buy. This is not a worldwide collapse. It is a problem. It's a worldwide problem. It is going to hurt for the next couple of years. But the idea that somehow we have had a wrenching end to Western capitalism just isn't there.
Let's go next to Colleyville and speak to Lester. Hey, Lester.
Hello. I have a question. Given what you just said, I was wondering if there's any, what type of political issues or instability or insecurities or changes we can see here in the United States in history in the past when there has been a crisis, or at least perceived as a crisis. Different rulers have come to power, and power has been seized, and different political thought tends to take hold. And I was wondering what you might see along that in the United States.
Yeah, well, we cycle back and forth from a moderate left point of view that celebrates the government to a moderate right point of view that opposes the government. And on both extremes, very small, the very loud people who demonize the other. We're now going through a left swing, very similar to Jimmy Carter's emergence after the crisis of 74, or Bill Clinton's emergence after the SNL meltdown. We go through stable crises. The thing that I'd like to point out about the United States is that we're a very young civilization, a very old country, but as a civilization, we're only 200 years old, and we do not have maturity, balance, and a sense of proportion. We're like 15-year-olds. If you've ever had a 15-year-old trip, they cycle through bipolar beliefs of utter catastrophe and total despair. And above all else, they evaluate their standing in the world by how popular they are with their friends. And if you listen to the last election, or you listen to American culture, we've gone over the past 5 years from extreme hubris to total despair, terrified that the French don't like us. I mean, I say the French because that always is the one that comes up, but it is a peculiarity of the United States that it overstates the problems it has and evaluates itself by how much is admired. It's very strange, unless you realize the United States is a very young civilization and we behave like 15-year-olds.
George, you write that ultimately there are no permanent solutions to geopolitical problems. Does that also mean there are no permanent holders of geopolitical power?
Of course not. Rome did quite a run, but then it became Italy. It became something else. The same of the British Empire, the French Empire, and every other. What I'm saying about the United States is that we are on the ascendancy, and I suspect it will be an ascendancy that will last for several centuries. But there is nothing permanent except that there's always ascending and descending powers. But the idea that there is a permanent end, a permanent solution that goes beyond all this, I mean, that really is the part of the argument I make that I'm passionate about. You go back over the past 3,000 years of human history, and I can chronicle the great, you know, the great empires that aren't there any longer. It's our turn now.
At the end of the day, you recommend we expect the unexpected. That has got to make a job like yours fascinating but maddening at the same time.
It really helps to be stupid. That's how I started this.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you are so smart that you understand that the German state of Schleswig-Holstein is going to vote this way, you will lose your mind. If you stay stupid and you say, Germany gets half of its energy from Russia, it can't get it anywhere else, the Germans will do what the Russians want, you can actually start sorting things out. But what I mean by, you know, anticipate the impossible is when I say to you that the next three great powers are going to be Japan, Turkey, and Poland, that seems preposterous. But I ask you then to go back to the beginning of the 1900s and imagine that some would say that the end of the 20th century, Britain, France, and Germany would all be minor powers. Their empire's gone. The great power would be this little third world country, the United States. And just imagine how amazing that would be. Imagine.
George Friedman's new book is called The Next 100 Years, A Forecast for the 21st Century. George, really interesting stuff. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.